But there's loads of them.
There's, it's the pink. Pink is in front, and then the black's in the back.
Oh, and then there's Brown's more reds.
There, and then, there should be,
Downstairs in Somerset House, past the corridor of artist studios, is the snooker room. A carpeted room with dark blue walls and a gigantic snooker table, where the artists sometimes meet for lunch and the odd game.
So then, do I have to start from over here?
Yeah.
Although, let's be honest, does anyone really know the rules of snooker?
You're supposed to hit the red.
Oh, well.
The studios is home to many different artists with varying practices. Set designers share space with movement artists, and filmmakers rub alongside musicians. Conversations which begin in the snooker room can go on to form long and meaningful collaborations. What subjects are driving these conversations? In this series, we listen in as two artists discuss a subject that is close to their heart over a game of snooker.
Oh, I've potted the whiteboard already.
Here, studios artists Gemma Desai and John Costi talk about their beginnings as artists and the ways that class is articulated in both their work and the art world through the lens of a book of essays by Dom Hunter called Chav Solidarity.
I thought we could maybe talk about that book that I sent you, Chav Solidarity. It was kind of like a memoir, but also a manifesto. It's like basically a collection of essays written by someone who is now a left organizer, but he grew up what he calls outside of earning class. And he moved into this space of like being university educated. And he talks about how he's changed. Yeah, I wanted to talk to you about it because it's so many of the themes that we talk about in the studio. I just thought it would be a nice way to kind of to talk about why we care about the things that we do.
I only made it through the first couple of essays, and then I had to put it down because it was just a bit too sensory for me. There was just some bits in it that was like it was quite similar to things I'd experienced, so I've had to put it down.
He talks about in the last few sections of the book, there's some essays which are about performing this working classness and performing for middle class audiences, and also knowing that that book is also for middle class audiences. I really felt that. Like, I feel like it is a book also about performance and how we embody things. And also he talks about how he, when he's like in these spaces with a lot of like lefty people who are like rendering him like the authentic voice, how he's like a dickhead in that space, and he knows that he is, and he like knows that he's like playing up to that, and he knows the power that he has in that space, but also he feels like he has a right to do that. Like, it's almost like revenge.
Yeah, it was really explicit and raw. He only learned how to write when he was in prison at 23 or something, right? Could you imagine what life he might have had if he had the opportunities that most people get? Which made me think about me, I think, as well, and how lucky I am, and how art's kind of been like my ticket out of a similar life to the guy that wrote that book. I was talking to some students yesterday, and I was like, I told them that art had given me like stability, it'd given me like an interesting life, a curious life. I didn't think I was ever kind of going to obtain. And so that's why I take this stuff quite seriously and I care that much about it, because of it was life and death for me, I think. Like, when if I didn't make the choice to give up on an old life and sort of put everything into this new, exciting thing called art, then I definitely wouldn't be here, but I probably wouldn't even be... I'd be in prison or dead. So sometimes I'm not that convinced by a lot of art, I think. It's not my thing, this sort of slick language work, because I think that we're artists, so we're responding to life and our lived experience, typically. And so I don't understand why that would be slick and clean, because my life ain't been slick and clean, you know?
Yeah, I think there's so much stuff in like what you said. First of all, like what I think about a lot with that book is like who gets to make sense of their experience. So that's something that he's really speaking to at the time, is like, he has this opportunity to make sense of his experience. But it's quite an angry book in the sense because he knows that the only people that are going to read it are people that don't really understand what he's been through. Because it's obviously like probably only middle class people have time and space and access to that book. You started talking about being an artist. Like, when did you start calling yourself an artist?
I think when I was really small. I remember like my dad had a little greengrocer's in Arnos Grove. Yeah. I remember one day I sat outside and I tried to do this like drawing of like the flats across the road. And I had this image of myself in my head, like a really sort of long moustached, beret wearing sort of, what did you call those?
Like a smock, like an art smock.
Yeah. Kind of French.
Is that what you wanted to be like, that kind of artist?
Yeah, that's what I thought an artist was.
But why did you want to be an artist? What was it about that character?
I think I wanted to leave the world I was in. And that's why I think that art should provide that portal into a new world, or at least into someone's world. When I was a kid, my brothers would play with like a computer, and I was never into that. And so my mum used to just get me wallpaper, like plain wallpaper, and I'd draw on it. But then I got a bit older and I lost that. And then when I was in prison, it kind of got reawakened during an art therapy session. And I remember that like desperation to be able to just use some colours in such a colourless place. Mm. And when I first got to art school, especially like CSM's new building was a bit like a prison. The only thing it didn't have was the suicide nets. But I've started calling myself an artist again to reinvent myself after that experience. And I went through this kind of conscious rebrand where I didn't want to be who I used to be. And I think that that's something that we should be doing every time we make an artwork, pretty much, like reinventing ourselves in some way or evolving.
Yeah. Go on, show me how it's done.
All right. Not like that. When did you decide you were an artist?
I started off like working more in like institutions and like doing more like programming and curatorial work. And I think like when you look back to like when you were younger, I think there's definitely like a few times of being like accused of like copying things or something, like people not believing that you'd written something. And then your experience at CSM, like the way you described it, is really interesting to me because I think through working in institutions, I started to process like other experiences in my life. Like when I was like younger, like I went through CAMHS, I like really struggled with my mental health. And I don't think I really realized that the ways that I'd navigated those systems was like knowledge. So when you described like going to CSM and seeing the space and how it functioned, that was really interesting because I think there's something I'm only just coming to realize is that some of the work that I've done about thinking about how institutions work or how you can't have feeling in these spaces that we work in came from also going through like other systems, like mental health systems or experiences in your life that nobody wants to talk about. Yeah. And I still have a lot of discomfort about the term artist because being an artist also like makes you different from everybody else. It feels wrong to make yourself somehow more important. And also like that thing in the book, which is like, who gets to make sense of their experience? Yeah. Oh, an artist does.
I was a CAMHS kid too. Just for our listeners, CAMHS is Child and Adolescent Mental Health Service. And I was diagnosed with chronic depression and PTSD at like 13. Mm-hmm. And then they gave me diazepam to sort that out. Didn't work. But I remember like when I was really small, I didn't talk that much. And I had to go and see a speech therapist once. And they asked me to draw something and I drew the genie from Aladdin, the Disney film. And I always remember that drawing because they praised me for it. Then when I got to prison, I did do some quite fun artworks. I covered like my entire ceiling with toilet roll and the screws really didn't like it. And I found like a notepad recently from when I was inside. And it's got like these mental public sculptures of like a prison issue toilet roll sandpaper sander and just stuff like that. And I thought, what? I was thinking like that back then. And I don't know whether that's because I didn't have anything to use, so I had to get super conceptual.
I've been thinking a little bit about this recently, about trying to
score.
Like having the opportunity to like value your experience and ones like it.
Yeah. Valuing my experiences, that's difficult as well, because often the experiences were flipping awful. Like the stuff that I've been compelled to make art about haven't been good things. I don't make nice art. I'm not compelled to. Most of these things started as coping mechanisms.
That really resonates, I think. But I think that's... I guess I also think there's a lot of work about trauma, and there's ways to deal with trauma that isn't very careful and that becomes very, it's easy just for it to just be about you and your trauma. And it's allowed me to think about, my experiences, the experiences of people who share similar experiences, as having this collective importance. But the way that we invite that in or care for that difficulty together is the way that we are together. That's been so useful as a discipline for me, not to just be I'm just telling my story even just coming on camera and saying that I was in CAMHS is maybe the first time that I've done that in an art context. But I feel like it's starting now to be important to disclose those really more raw experiences to show why I care about the more refined things.
Yeah, your experience will help others. You know, if you share it in the right way, in the right conditions. Is that two?
Almost, but see, I'm not missing them, which is sort of amazing, isn't it? Now the black.
Well, you want to kind of put the highest value ball, which would, if you can't put the black, it would be pink. If you can't put the pink, it would be blue.
I feel in what you just taught me about snooker, there's something about art. You can't put the most valuable one on the table.
This is the art market here in front of us. And we're just the Red Bulls.
Yeah, I know, exactly.
So the artists are the Red Bulls. So what's the black ball then? The black ball might be a really serious director. And then maybe curators and gallerists. Let's not do that.
I don't think we'll get very far on this table.
Oh, that was a foul.
What is it about making art? Is there anything about art that scares you?
Yeah, it's really intimidating. It's really intimidating. I remember when I first got to art school, I was well scared. I was well they're all going to know that I'm not good and that I'm this and that I'm that. Because all I'd heard for so many years before was that I wasn't good. And then to make something and get praise for it was that was a sort of defining moment for me to think, let me keep going with this. That felt good. Maybe I can do good. Maybe I don't have to take from the world and maybe I can contribute to it.
Yeah. You know, there's this word raw that I think about a lot. Maybe rawness is quite important to me. And I had a lot of shame around that for a really long time, that all of my work was too messy, that it wasn't polished enough.
I'm with you.
Or that it just it wasn't anything, basically, because I don't make things. I do things and I think about things. But now I feel there's something in rawness, and that's really patronized also in art. It's the work is very raw. But you can be raw and still very skillful.
Yeah, I done a show early last year, which was really raw. And it was me reading through loads of legal documents, some from CAMHS, and then shredding them and sort of ad-libbing my life a bit. I went to really great lengths to make sure that the people that were invited would be people that might benefit from it, so that I'd had experience in the criminal justice system, were youth workers, were, had family members that weren't particularly well. And then I'm doing a similar project at the moment, and people want me to do it in an art space, and I'm it's just not suitable. The art space is not that suitable for rawness. People are really concerned about making stuff for galleries. If anything, we want to get the stuff from outside and put it in a gallery and try and keep it as real as what it was outside, inside. But people get the stuff from outside, take away the rawness, and then tune it into this white cube space. And I think that that's a disservice.
Well, I suppose I think of it as like also self-policing. I think about that like quite a lot, about slow domestication of yourself. And like for me, it hasn't been as dramatic. Your story sounds quite like, you know, there are turning points to your story. And I think for me, it's like happened very slowly over time. And sometimes coming into a world like this, you are sort of translating things, domesticating things all the time.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
I think when it's like trauma-centric work as well, it's damage control.
Yeah.
In a way, like I work with guys that are coming out of prison, and I tell them like when we're using their real lived experience, that we use like archaeological terms. So instead of digging up the past, we're excavating with like the correct tools, and then we present it in like a climate controlled room, which just means that like there isn't going to be someone like laughing, getting drunk at the back when someone's pouring their heart out, basically. And I've told some people about this project, and they're like, oh yeah, why don't you do it here? And it's like, I've actually got a community centre in Stevenage, and that's way more suitable. That's where the people are going to feel comfortable. And this isn't a show, this is an exorcism, or this is a ritual of some sort. It's not. And we're not exhibiting, like, our pain, like, just for you lot. Like, even exhibiting is a weird word for it. To exhibit, I think, is quite naked. And if you don't have any safety in, like, in that moment, then that can make you really spiral. And that's happened to me. That's definitely happened to me a couple of times. But I'm really protective of what I've built now. And I think coming here to Somerset House has helped me realise that I need to. Because, like you said before, the idea of being in the art world, I still don't know exactly what the art world is. Like, what art world? Whose art world? Which one? I think that's quite a difficult thing to navigate in art as well, is that, like, you know, ego or hierarchy. Like, I've done this, and that means that I'm that. And it's like, it doesn't really. If you're just nice, then, like, I'll have a lot more time for you than if you, you know, exhibit at the Venice Biennale. I don't really care. Like, if you're a dickhead, you're a dickhead. Like, I'll say that. Like, I'm sorry if that gets cut, but, like, that's kind of how I always see things.
No, and I think there's something also about, like, there's so much in, like, what you just said. I think there's certain experiences in life that allow you to see through things, that you just cut through things. You're like, you can see exactly what's going on. And I think in that book that we were talking about right at the beginning, he talks about how there's not people that are better than each other. It's just people are paid off for different amounts to not notice things.
Yeah, I like that.
And I think, like, I guess that's also the thing, is like the more that you get rewarded, the more you're supposed to like ignore things. And I think maybe that's the feeling of being gentrified, like, is you're being paid off more, you're getting more to ignore. But it's also making me think about, like, it's not the space, it's not like this anonymous place, it's about how we are in the place. So a friend of mine, Adam, recently I did like a workshop with them, and they were talking about being a good audience member, like, how do you do that? And I was like, what do you mean? And they were like, you know, like when someone's talking and sharing their thing, you're like listening to them, and like you're showing that you're listening, right? And to me, that was like, oh God, yeah, like that's what I've needed, like when I've been up on stage, but I've never think about doing it in that space. So it's just making me think about like how much we need to be able to receive what we have to offer. Like, it's not just like these bad systems, it's like how we are with each other.
We're doing okay.
We're doing okay.
We're doing all right.
We're just knocking the balls around, basically.
Yeah.
You can't go backwards, can you?
You can.
You can?
Yeah, you can. You can't shoot backwards if from a foul.
You know the little things that we include in our works that maybe nobody else knows about, but they're for us?
Little sort of cue cards.
And for me, it's always like my daughter is always in my work, like somewhere, because I think that the main reason I want to have been thinking about these ideas is because, one, I want to help her to understand these things in ways that I didn't have anyone to help me to understand what was going on. And also how that was shaped by the world that we live in, like the structural, like part of our good and bad experiences, right? And also this compulsion to like say and do these things has come after having her. And there's this thing that I learned about recently called matrescence, which is like adolescence. It's like a biological, social, like transformation that women go through when they have a child.
You never hear about that.
Right. And I was like, when I found out about it recently, I was like, oh my God, this is it. And so many of the experiences that I've been processing, like CAMS, like all of that stuff around that time that I'm now putting into this work that I'm working on at the moment, which is also about mothering, is going back to the adolescent time.
Yeah.
One of my favorite like performance artists is Lorraine O'Grady, and she writes loads about her performance practice because she started out as a writer. And she talked about how like performance allows her to have multiple dimensions. I think there's something about like experience in itself, like you're allowed to experiment with experience yeah. in art.
Even like timelines and different yeah. versions of you or potential versions. Like
yeah.
in that same show, there was a version of me that was still in prison because he got IPP, which is imprisonment for public yeah. protection. In the show, I met up with this version of myself. And we had a fight, basically, but then we hugged. And even, like I think, like, having compassion for a younger self is something quite new for me, because I've been, like, so full of shame and, like, trying to outrun, like, a sort of a ghost of me, or, like, I didn't really take the time to mourn that person or that child, which I feel like I have done a bit now. But, like, it still hurts, to be honest.
Something, what you're saying makes me sort of think about, like, working in different forms. So, like, I've like made stuff that is just about my experience before, but then alongside maybe I'll like have a film screening, or alongside I might hold a workshop, or like I do like somatic work. And I think like working in those multiple ways helps me to stay in the right relationship with that story. And
yeah.
because of that thing that we said right at the beginning, like nobody really wants to hear about this stuff unless it's in a certain context.
Like the bad boy done good, people like that. But it's like, it's not that simple. It's never simple.
It makes me think about the edges of the work as well.
Mm.
You know, that it doesn't just end when you like just say something in front of lots of people or you do a project. It's like leaking everywhere, isn't it, into your life?
Yeah. And like, again, like people are happy to talk about stuff if there's like a win at the end.
Or if it's finished.
Yeah.
If they think it's finished.
Like, he's fine now. But I think like if I ever made an artwork that I thought was finished, I don't know why I'd keep making artwork. I feel like I've done it now. It's the same as healing, like it's still a continuous like vein. It's every day. Like we spoke a bit about my thesis when I was doing my MA. And my thesis was like, I had 6 months to write it. So I started it and I said, by the end of this thesis, I'm going to be middle class. And that's all like, I've kind of ever wanted. But in the process of like becoming middle class, right, you lose something that you can't kind of regain. And there's like a real feeling of like being a traitor to like my mates I grew up with. Like they want to hang around and do fuck all. And it's like, oh, you've changed. Well, yeah, that's the point. I don't want that life. I don't want a life where like I have to drink and do drugs in order to just get through the week. Do you know what I mean? Like loads of people do. Yeah.
But there is a loss, I think about that as well. Like maybe also choosing certain forms to like do your work in won't always be legible to the people that will understand it the most in a way,
yeah.
which is always like this weird thing that I'm always thinking about. Is like, oh, okay, if I want to impress people in a certain world, then the way that I'll write certain things like won't
ring true for like
for
people.
Others, yeah. yeah. Like for instance, like my parents would never understand anything
yeah.
that I've ever made. Or like, and I remember once like there was a video that I made at the end of that project, and I wanted them to watch it, and they said they watched it. And this was so horrible, actually. They were like, "Watched it twice. We don't know what you're talking about." And it was like real pain. Like, oh God, we can't speak to each other through this thing. I think that's where like a lot of the sadness in my work comes from. And that's like maybe the last thing that I wanted to also talk to you about was like, there's this line from this Audre Lorde poem that I've been like thinking about for like years. And it's, the poem is called "There Are No Honest Poems About Dead Women." And the first line is, "What do we want from each other after we've told our stories?" It's not about telling like my story, is telling our stories. And I think that that's the thing that maybe I get frustrated with people who are scared of vulnerability in the art world, will be like, oh God, that's just trauma porn. But I think that's actually quite rare. Most people do want like some sort of witness.
Yeah.
And that in itself is like a political demand.
The witness is participants. I guess they're not, because they're just that.
Well, you're implicated when you witness something.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you just watch it, like disinterested, then it's like, oh, that's happening to you. But in the act of witnessing something, you're changed by something, you know. But yeah, I think there's something about the desire to share that is asking that question of like, what do I want from everyone around me now? Should we leave it there?
Yeah, I think...
Well, we'll carry on in our studio anyway.
Yeah, we'll carry on indefinitely.
Thanks to Gemma Desai and John Costi. For this podcast, we did something a little different and filmed a companion video. So to watch a film version of this conversation, head to Channel on the Somerset House website. The podcast was produced by Alana Chance and exec produced by Eleanor Ritter Scott. The music is by George Borman. Gemma Desai's exhibition, There Are No Honest Poems About Dead Women, is open in G31 at Somerset House until the 1st of November. Thanks for listening.